Welcome to the broadcast. This is Michael Easley in Context, and we're excited to bring you a guest today. I'm non-anxious about our guest today. Dr. John Deloney is a mental health expert. He has two PhDs. One wasn't enough, so he went and got two. One in counselor education and supervision, and the other in higher education administration. Those are the people I try to avoid, John. Before joining before he joined Ramsey Solutions in 2020, he spent two decades in crisis response, helping people go through trauma in their life. He's been at Ramsey Solutions now, and he writes, speaks, teaches on relationships, mental health, anxiety, which is what we're going to talk about today, and wellness. He's also the co-host of The Ramsey Show, which is the second largest talk show in the nation right now. 18 million listeners a week. Back when I was in radio broadcasting, those numbers were unheard of, so very exciting to see what's going on. He's also the host of the Dr. John Deloney Show, and he put a book out, Own Your Past and Change Your Future, which became a number one national bestseller, and that's been followed by the book we're going to talk about today. But he's also featured on Daily Mail TV, Fox Business News, and the Minimalists Podcast. Dr. John Deloney, Building a Non-Anxious Life, which came out in October of 23. Thanks for joining the podcast, friend.
I'm just honored to be here with you, man. It's good. It's fun to hang out privately, and it's also fun to hang out publicly, so it's good, man.
Absolutely. Well, you've had a whirlwind change, so for those that don't know you, you came from Texas, and tell them a little bit about your story from Texas to Nashville.
Man, I was a dean of students at universities for the last 17, 18 years, and a professor, just a nerd. My wife and I were looking for what's the place where we can settle in and just, I hate to use the word dream job because I think that's kind of silly, but what's a place where we can go be somewhere for 10 years, 15 years and plant some roots for our kids. I ended up in what was my dream job at Belmont University as the dean of students there. And so we packed up and moved. And in the course of the few months before we left, man, it really exposed some major cracks in our marriage. It was just a mess. Then I got here. Instantly, the matriarch in her family, her grandmother, beloved, incredible woman, passed away. So we had to go back and we took separate flights back. It was a mess. But in the process, I forgot that they had told me, hey, when you get back, the day you get back, you have to give a speech here at Belmont called The Vision for Belmont. And I was like, I worked here 4 days. I don't have a vision yet. I just got here. So I got back. My marriage was a mess. My work was a mess. The transition was a mess. And by the way, if you grew up in Texas, when you leave, they tell you that Al-Qaeda is waiting at the Arkansas border just to kill everybody who leaves Texas. And so it was a whole thing. So I come here and sat down on my laptop. I was like, enough's enough. And I wrote a talk that I had to give. It ended up being probably the best talk I've ever given in my life. Wow. And Dave's executive VP was in the audience dropping off her daughter. And she said, I'm going to hire that guy. And I didn't realize that I embarked on about a 2-year interview with Ramsey. And now I'm, as my son says, I'm a YouTuber. he's like, remember you had a real job, Dad? And now you're just a YouTuber? And I'm like, thanks, son. Thanks, son.
Say, boy, you're eating that real job right there on the plate tonight.
That's right. That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
It's funny. You and I crossed paths on this when you were writing first sort of the paper that became a book. And now this text, one of my mentors for 15 years, he's with the Lord now, Floyd Sharp. We used to meet pretty much every 2 weeks. He was a retiring psychologist, a Christian psychologist, and just became an extraordinary encourager to me. But he would always say, Michael, you're a perfectionist, you're too anxious. And he would always quote, anxiety in the heart of a man weighs down, but a good word lifts up. And I would go, why do you think I'm a perfectionist? And he goes, well, look at your shirt. Because I always wore starched shirts, you know. I said, well, that's, you know, I was preppy before it was cool. And denial is a fun place to stay when you don't want to look in the mirror.
Yes, it is.
Now, just jump in because there's a lot of good stuff in your book. And for our friends, you know, one of the things I'm accused of routinely is, Michael, you're just pushing books down our throats. Here's the deal. If one of our guests lines up with where you are, then take a look at it. This is not meant to make you buy one or two books a week. It's meant to encourage you in your walk with Christ. Or if you don't know Christ, or what's this crazy Christian nonsense, we want to provoke you to think critically who you are, if there's a God, who he is, and what it means to know Christ. So just take a big breath. Don't be anxious about this interview. But John, you write, for years, I've been telling anyone who would listen, students, counselors, colleagues, even myself, Anxiety is just a smoke alarm letting you know something in your house is on fire. The alarm is not the problem. The fire is. And that's helpful for a lot of us to think about, wait, I'm anxious. I can feel it. The cortisol's going up. My, you know, chest is getting red. My hands are, however we manifest it. But that's not the problem.
I don't think we got here on purpose. I don't think we're coordinated enough to get here in a some sort of like malfeasant way. But I think we've been trying to solve for comfort the last 150 years, 200 years. And as we've solved for things that have plagued humanity forever, like water, and food, and only three people in your tribe to marry, right? And now we have millions on swiping and swiping. But as we solve these things, the enemy has become not survival and death, it's become discomfort. And so we've begun to pathologize these innate normal systems that our body has that I think we're designed with to keep us safe and keep us alive. And one of those is anxiousness, anxiety. It's just letting you know that there's some things in your environment that your body's detected that may mean you're not safe. And because we're not solving for life anymore, we're solving for discomfort. Now we race to a doctor, we race to some sort of numbing agent. I heard one physician say, we're Netflixing ourselves to death. We've just created this distraction universe for ourselves. And if you look at the data, we can't have all become anxious at the same time because of genetics or because somehow people are broken all of a sudden. That begs a question, why is everyone's body ringing off the hook at the same time? And I think that's a much more instructive question. How have we created a world that our bodies were never designed to live in?
You know, it was Swinson wrote the book Margins. I remember reading it when it first came out, and it made so much sense. There's a lure for well-intentioned people. Busyness is important. Performance is important. And then, of course, in my lifetime, you know, social media has been a crazy thing. The screen generation doesn't know any different. But there's been a tectonic shift in activity. You mentioned dating apps, for example, you swipe. That's got to increase anxiety.
Following your train of thought, which I love, going back to like the moral majority conversation, was that back in the 80s?
Sure.
Here's 7 or 8 behaviors or 10 behaviors that are specifically outlined in scripture as evil and bad, and we have to root them out. And so let's take one like addiction. It's easy to look at somebody who's struggling with addiction, who's got a sexual addiction or an alcohol addiction or a drug addiction, an illicit drug addiction, and say, they're bad and that's bad behavior. And I'm going to go over here and work 125 hours a week, get paid extra overtime for it, and be celebrated and cheered on. I'm using that to ignore my family, to not say out loud, I don't know how to be a dad. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't really love the person I'm married to anymore. We're great household co-managers. Or I'm going to now, in our current ecosystem, I'm going to scroll and swipe my day away. I'm going to let my kids be the epicenter of our home, and I'm going to go to 14 different practices a week, my life away, right? But I think all of it is this pervasive numbing agent. And yeah, social media is, I mean, it's a group of neuroscientists who got with a group of technology guys, and you can't beat it. I mean, it's infinitely more addictive than the crack epidemic or the, you know, opioid epidemic, and it's pumped into our homes, and we're handing smartphones to children. It's like nothing we've ever experienced before.
We're jumping way ahead in your book, and one thing I appreciate about your book is it's not inaccessible. You touch enough on sort of the research and the observations, but you're getting more at the heart of the matter on how we look for turning down anxiety. But dopamine, in the last 2 decades, we've talked a lot about cortisol, oxytocin, and dopamine. One of my dentist friends told me that the reason Instagram users do this or chew fingernails is dopamine. And that was a light bulb to me. I hadn't thought about it in those terms.
It's a highly orchestrated, intentional, from the swipes to how they hold back who's liked your post until certain times, hold back which post you can see because they know you're going to be engaged with this one, but not these 5, but they're trying to get some more information in front of you in those 5. All of that is incredibly orchestrated. The fonts they use, the colors they use, everything is orchestrated for one thing, to keep your attention. And dopamine is the drug. People think it's the drug of pleasure. It's not. It's the chemical of anticipation. So it builds and it builds and it holds and it holds and then it releases. Anna Lemke, she's wrote a masterpiece, Dopamine Nation, but she talks about your body's response to dopamine is it has to hit the other side of the teeter-totter. It has to hit a pain. That's what withdrawal is, right? That's when addicted to love. As Pia Melody writes about, when you're addicted to a person and they're gone, it hurts. It actually hurts. And so you're swiping, and when you stop, your body hits that other side of that teeter-totter and you feel it. I got to get back on this thing. And that's addiction. And the problem is, when you're doing drugs, when you're drinking, when you're working 160 hours, you know it's not healthy. But when you're scrolling and you're trying to seek out your friends, you're trying to seek out people like you, it's nefarious, right?
Let me go back. We talk a lot about all these things, but one of the things you identify real quickly is what we're doing isn't working.
Right. Yeah. More people, I like to say it, more people than ever before in human history are under the care of a licensed mental health professional. That's my gang. That's my world. More people than ever before in human history are taking psychotropic medication, right? And by the way, I took meds and they transformed and saved my life. So I'm not anti-med. I'm just saying, if we step back and look at, okay, we've medicated people, we've got all the right things for people, and the trend line is still through the roof, then you have to ask yourself, is this working? And it's not. It's not.
So typically, we try to do compensatory things. If a person is anxious or stressed out a lot, they go, I need to take a break. I need to stop. I need to eat a candy bar. I need to go shopping online. You know, there's different compensatory behavior, but that doesn't do anything.
I mean, it numbs it, right? It tapes a pillow over that alarm that's going off in your kitchen. And so it does silence the anxiousness, but then your house burns down, right? It doesn't solve the problem. And one of the things, I didn't know this before I started the research for the book, and it was really annoying. One of the most annoying characteristics of anxiety is if your body's anxious about something. So let's say you're anxious about having hard conversations or confrontation or social situations. When you get anxious about something, your boss invites you to a dinner and you're anxious about social situation. And you're like, and you don't go. Your body won. It got exactly what it wanted, which was you not to be around the threat. So what does that do? It reinforces the anxiety response. So the next time you get invited, it's going to gin it up even louder because it knows, oh, that keeps him from going to this, that's where the tigers and bears are. And so the only way to heal from it, and it's super annoying, is to go right through it, is to head right into it. And that goes against every ounce of what our body wants us to do and what our culture wants us to do.
Well, it's sort of like you allude to your speech, and speeches in general cause huge anxiety for people, not in their stomach. I remember in seminary, we had preaching courses, and they were pretty intimidating because you have a professor behind the glass recording it and taking notes, and then the class would evaluate you afterwards, and it's a pretty interesting environment. But we had one guy, he got up, and bless his heart, I mean, you couldn't use notes. You could use your Bible, but you couldn't use anything in print. And he got up, and he choked. These were 15-minute sermonettes. They weren't, you know, full-born. Great professor. After we're in the circles, and he says to this guy, I'll call him Reed. He goes, Reed, I'd like to see you with your favorite chair at home, your favorite football team, your favorite friends, eating, you know, whatever you like, pizzas or wings, whatever you like. Your team's winning, but it's a great game. I'd like to see that when you stand up. Oh, that's a good picture. Well, we had three of these messages in the course of the semester. He did it again. He got up and he just choked. I just say that to, you know, illustrate. It's not uncommon. This is a highly educated guy, very bright guy, very competent guy. But there was a certain threshold for him. His body just shut down, John.
It shut down. That's right. But also, as you're saying that, I thought to myself, and he has been freed. Because what he's going to find is his mom didn't suddenly hate him. He might find he needs to take a different career path because this isn't the job for you. But you find out, I didn't die, right? The worst thing that your body was screaming at you, this is it. This is all over. It's not, right? And so you head into these situations. He was set free. All right, cool. I'm not going to be a pastor or a preacher. This is not the gig for me. I get anxious when I'm trying to fix something like a car or a lawnmower or something because I'm a disaster at it. And I can knucklehead my way through it. And I come out all, I got to go repent for all the things I've said, muttered under my breath, and I lose things and whatever. And I can learn that's not the job for me long term, but I also learn I could do it if I need to, right? So your body, you learn by going through the ugh. But yeah, you get set free. Once you fail on a public stage and you realize it's not all over, there's nothing else that your body can hold over you, right? We're free.
You write about Dr. Winnie Suzuki, and she says, anxiety is our psychological and physical response to stress, a hardwired threat response that our brain body uses to protect us.
Which she goes on to say, which in some way makes anxiety your friend. It's just your buddy saying, hey, don't step out in the street. There's a car coming. And if you make peace with anxiety, nobody likes to be anxious. And by the way, I've been doubled over with it. I almost cost me my career. It almost cost me my marriage. I didn't know what it was. It's awful. But instead of looking at it, like if somebody was screaming in my ear, there's a car coming, I look at him and said, man, that's really loud on my eardrum, right? That's not the right response. The right response is to jump out of the way of the car and then ask myself, whoa, how did I miss that? Let's have that conversation.
Dr. Judson Brewer, I like this quote that she said, at first, anxiety is simply an alarm that sounds in response to a trigger. Over time, the actions that turn down the alarms become habits. We reach for our phone, a donut, a drink, whatever, we get stressed. Eventually, these habits develop into full-blown addictions. And that gets kind of chilling.
Judd Brewer is kind of the guru when it comes to healing from anxiety. I think he runs a clinic at Yale. He's I'm like a middle school basketball player and he's Michael Jordan. He's very, very sharp. The easy way to think of it is you get addicted to anxiety. There's some debate in the academic world about whether your body gets addicted to the cortisol and adrenaline, the pulsing, the feeling aliveness. And so you keep having to go back to your drug of choice, whether it's work, whether it's love, whether it's alcohol, whether it's Netflix, to turn off the anxiety, or if your body needs over time the drug, and it will spin you up because it knows where you're headed. It knows you're going to go back to alcohol. You're going to go back to whatever it is that numbs you out. Either way, it doesn't matter. I think the important thing is if you are anxious and you stay anxious, you stay in anxious environments, your body over time will become addicted to that anxiety. And that's when you got a problem.
So help me differentiate a little bit between anxiety and stress.
Stress is good. Stress is, I was almost late to staff meeting. And if you know Dave Ramsey, you know, don't be late to staff meeting.
Don't be late, period.
Don't be late ever to anything, ever. But especially staff meeting. Last week, I was late to staff meeting, and there's 1,000 people in the staff meeting, and I was the first announcement, and I was late. So I had to come up late, and then like I walked on stage, and the whole audience goes, ooh, right? And it was a whole thing. And so this morning, I was running late again. My wife and kids are out of town, so I had the greatest morning of my life, which I usually have on day one. Tomorrow, it'll just be a disaster, but today was great. I was hustling. That stress that my body was like, hey, we got to go. That's good. I worked out really hard this morning. I put my body under load. I stressed my body out so that it could come back stronger. That's good. Anxiety is an alarm system. It's different than stress.
Let me interrupt for a second. So when people say, I'm really stressed at work, or I'm really stressed at my marriage, are they really saying I'm anxious at work, I'm anxious in my marriage?
No, they've either been thrown into a life or they're choosing a life where stress is chronic. It's 24/7, 365. And our bodies are really amazingly designed to deal with acute stress. It's designed for the tiger to show up at the door and you either fight it or you run from it or you hide from it or you play dead and it gnaws off one of your legs and drags you under a pile of leaves and comes back tomorrow and hopefully you can escape then, right? That's what our bodies are designed for. It's not designed for this 24/7, 365, every threat on planet Earth coming through this little digital box at us 24/7, 365. It can't handle that. The machinery is not designed for that. It's like taking a Toyota Camry, one of the greatest machines ever made, taking it rock climbing. It's not what it was designed to do. And so you can blame the car, but really you should blame the driver in that situation.
All right. You go into a section on memory, action, and grief. I thought that was very insightful to think about how these affect our levels of anxiety.
Yeah. I like to think of it this way. Your body goes through a stressful event or a thing, and it puts a GPS pin in it. And what it's doing is it's surveying the environment 24/7, 365 for that threat again. An easy way to remember this is the things that kept you safe as a kid will destroy your adult relationships. Hmm. If dad was an alcoholic and he came home and you knew, I got to get wild and loud so he'll come for me and not mom. Or I need to get really small and just go to my room. Dad wasn't an alcoholic. He was just always angry. His back always hurt. He's always just grumpy. So I'm just going to go to my room, shut the door. Then you get married and your wife or husband comes home and your body just starts to, it just, here's the car coming up the driveway and you find yourself just washing your hands up and you head to the room and you shut the door. those kind of things will destroy your marriage, because you're going to marry somebody who has attachment issues and wants to see you. And then your body's going to be screaming at you, go. And it's going to be screaming, they're running from us. And so it just gets in this loop. And so, yeah, memory, all these things are connected in a really beautiful, non-academic way. But you got to call out the GPS pin. That's why it's important just to ask yourself, instead of racing to stop the anxiousness, ask yourself, whew, what's my body trying to protect me from? Mm. And that's a way more instructive question.
Years ago, when we were, let's say, trying to be more aware of our surroundings, you know, with school shootings and whatever, and one of the things that I learned and I tried to impart to my wife and some of our family was, look, the awareness thing, the white, yellow, orange. I said, if you go in the parking lot and you feel something's wrong, leave.
Leave.
When you get your keys to your car and you're getting out and it just doesn't feel right when you walk in that store, go home. You know, trust your gut. And is that stress or is that anxiety?
If I'm being super honest, I don't know that it matters.
Okay. My point is, you're trying to neurosynaptically create a different response to something, whether power through it or ignore it. You're saying, well,
I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Yeah. So what I find is trust your gut and seek counsel. What I know about my body is when I get emotional about something or when it floods something, when I get anxious about something, my body actually shuts off the critical thinking part of my brain. Yeah. It just wants me to respond. And so if every time I roll into a school parking lot, I just have to get out of there. I can't avoid going to school if I'm in college. I can't avoid going to school if I've got a child in school. So I need to go sit down with somebody and ask, seek counsel. Is this as bad as I think it is? Mm. One of the weird GPS pins my body put in with an anxiety alarm attached to it was money. I grew up, my dad was a policeman and then he became a minister. We had nothing. We had very, very little. And it was tough because I was surrounded by gajillionaires. And then I got older and then I got older and then I started moving up in my career and every paycheck was still that same alarm would go off every time that direct deposit would come. And I had to go sit with a professional counselor and say, hey, I need to walk through this because I know it's not real anymore. It used to be, it's not anymore. And that's what healing is. Can I think about those old scary things and my body doesn't take off on me anymore? But always, I mean, if you're pulling into a parking lot and something feels like, get in your car and go, right? Get in your car and go.
And metaphorically in any situation in life, I would say.
Yeah. Until it becomes disruptive to a point where it's not real anymore, right? If showing up to your office is unsafe, and you quit and you go get a new job and it's unsafe, go talk to somebody.
Something else, yeah. You also quote Rollo May, and that took me back to, I was thinking 1976, I was introduced to Rollo May at college, reading a lot of his stuff, but it says, one measure of allaying anxiety is frantic activity.
Yeah.
And so—
welcome to our 21st century, man.
So when I start feeling anxious, I get busier.
Yeah. Just got to go do something. I got to call somebody. I got to text somebody. I got to scroll something. I got to buy something. What we're not trained to do in this current world is just be still. Just be still. I mean, that's what military training does for you. That's what boxing training, that's what MMA training does, that's what jiu-jitsu training does. In the chaos of an engagement, the calmest person often wins. Can you stay, right? When I was training MMA, I used to, if you could get somebody mad at you, oh, that's awesome. Because they're going to overreact. They're going to do something silly. It's the person who stays super, super calm.
Under fire. 6 daily choices of a non-anxious life. And I'll read them all and we can talk about a couple of them. Choose reality, choose connection, choose freedom, choose health and healing, and choose belief. So first of all, I'm anxious, but what's my reality? I need to choose to sit in that reality.
Yeah, I think we've talked about it a little bit, but we call it the attention economy, is that they call it these days. That's a nice way of saying we live in the distraction economy.
Okay.
Look over here, look over here, look over here. And so everybody and their grandma has a vested financial interest in you feeling unsettled and trying to chase the solution externally. That's why I buy stuff. That's why I buy a new course. That's why I buy new shirts. That's why I buy new shoes, a new car, a new house. My kids go to another school and another school and another school. That's why I get a new spouse, a new girlfriend, because I'm always chasing this external. Once I get this thing, then I'll feel okay. That's distraction. And so if you want to be well, well comes from the inside out. And if you want to be well from the inside out, you've got to know where to start. And so starting is you got to choose reality. And that's taking an inventory. Like I work for Dave Ramsey, like write down how much you owe on a piece of paper. Write it all down. Get it all out into the open. be honest. What's the state of your marriage? What's the state of your relationship with your kids? It's easy when you walk in and you have a teenager and they shut the door and all those teens, but your body knows. Your body knows. We are 6 feet apart from each other, but we're 6,000 miles away from each other, mm-hmm. right? And so it's this, what's the state of your health? How overweight are you? Is your job about to go away because of AI? Like, let's be honest about some of these things. Or here's a better one. What can you actually do about crisis X, Y, and Z on the other side of the globe? Really? What can you act? I think that's why we go crazy during national elections, because there's so much fervor and all of us go to the polls and we get one ping pong ball toss into the little jar for the goldfish. We get one throw and then we move on. And it's all this pent up anger and rage and 24/7. You cast one vote and then you go on to your house and you hope your guy wins. It's this sense of what can you actually do? And so when it comes to voting, obviously I'm a big believer in that, but backing all the way out, choose reality. Is you constantly scrolling and watching the news and screaming, is that helping? Or are you using that to avoid the things that would make your life better? Like paying all your debts off, learning how to be a better dad, getting connected with your spouse again, going for a walk, things that actually heal instead of create more fire.
Well, you touched on the next one, choosing connection. And, you know, reading through this section, I almost hesitate talking about it, but I've got five guys that are closer than brothers. And one of them, yes, I know for 57 years.
Amazing.
And you just don't have those kind of friendships normally. And just, I think God knew I needed it to survive. I touch base with them all the time. I'm able to connect with them as well as Cindy, but it's a construct for me, John, but most people don't have healthy connections.
Yeah, we've created the loneliest generation in human history. It just is. And we all know the anecdote, right? 70-90% of communication is nonverbal. We know that. But we've outsourced everything to text messages and emojis. And so I can text my wife 100 times a day. I love you. I love you. I love you. I love you. I'm giving her data. She gets the information, but her body doesn't feel safe. Not as though I walk in the door and I come in hot. I get done meeting with Dave and I'm ranting and raving. I walk in the front door and I can't, but, and her body is asking, does that guy love me? Is he safe?
Yeah.
Does that guy love me? Is he safe? Is he safe? I'm thinking, I already told you 100 times today that I love you.
Exactly.
It's different. Or I'm real guilty of this. I have a couple of friends that are 40 plus year friends. Maybe we see each other every 10 years now, every 5 years in person. We text a lot. And I like to pretend that that's the same and it's not. Our bodies have to be in proximity to other people. We can get super nerdy, which I won't do to your poor listeners, but your body knows where it is in space in relation to other people. That's how it balances itself in space. And we've just taken that all away and we outsource it all. And so our bodies are dying literally of loneliness while we have more friends and more people to communicate with than ever before.
Well, they're acquaintances.
There you go.
You know, a differentiated friend. A friend is somebody that knows my secrets and I know theirs. It's somebody that,
that's right,
you know,
and loves you anyway.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Anyway. Yeah. Yeah. You can be a dirt bag and they go, yeah, you're a dirt bag, you know. as my friend Dave Gibson says, I don't know if you need a dope slap or encouragement right now. You know, it's one of these, I need to come down.
And a good friend
there.
Does both, right?
Exactly.
Good friend does both.
Exactly. I'm going to go back a little bit. You talked about money, and I've got this, let's just say, not the best illustration theologically, but when the garden temptation and when John writes about lust of the flesh, lust of the eye, and the boastful pride of life, that, you know, the fruit looked good, it would make one wise, so forth. And I've kind of reduced that to money, sex, and power. Then we've got these three umbrellas in life, money, sex, and power, and we tend to have a interest in one more than other. There's certainly overlap, but a lot of what you're talking about with anxiety seems to fall into, I'm anxious about money, I never have enough. Sex is such an alluring, distorted thing in our culture, you never have enough. Power, there's always someone in the room that's got more power than you, unless, you know, you're running the thing. And if you're running the thing, you're still controlling that power. So money, sex, and power seem to interfere a lot. And as I look just a simple Christian life of one of those is winding your watch, you know, one of those is really pulling at you. And that's where I would get anxious. You mentioned money. I grew up in a home where dad would say, I wish I could teach you more about money. And that's what the message I grew up with. He was very conservative financially. We were very poor based on the neighborhood, but we didn't know any better. It wasn't like a bad thing. It was like, this is all we had. And so my brother and I overcompensate in some respects. We don't want to be that. But then you get to this, well, we still wonder about money. So are we ever going to, here's the question, sorry, doctor, are we ever going to have a healthy tension or stress with our alignment to whatever drives us nuts or creates anxiety?
Well, and again, this is in real time, but as you're saying that, man, that rings so true to me. And if I think of the neuroscience, if we were to go back a couple thousand years and you open your eyes one morning and your tribe had left you out in the plains of northern Missouri, your tribe had left you, your body knows you're going to die. You're going to die of exposure. You're going to get eaten by something. You can't do all of the safety and you can't do all of the food gathering and the food prep and the shelter. You can't. You're not going to make it. And it sounds the alarm. The proxy for connected, I have a purpose and I got a role and I sit in this responsibility. I both share it and I carry it. The proxy for that, the cheap duct tape substitute, is sex. And if I think of power, if I am subjected to somebody else, I'm not safe. And so what's our culture tell us? Then you need to be on top. And if I go to money, if I have this thing, if I, my happiness is just over the next. So all that distills down neurologically to me to that word safety. And it's this illusion that we're chasing and chasing and chasing and chasing and chasing this. When I get this thing, then whew, my body will feel safe. And so, yeah, man, I think all three of those things have some very fundamental roots in anxiousness, anxiousness, anxiousness. And the only way to solve them is to get way upstream. Right? I'm going to do the hard, scary, annoying work of trying to make adult friends. That's the worst, doc. It's the worst. Going up to strangers and being like, hey, you want to be my friend? And then you finally go hang out. Y'all get nachos. You're having a drink. You're just talking about whatever. And then one moron's like, what do you think of COVID? And like, well, we're not friends anymore. Like, and then you move on. And then somebody at work who's not your wife texts you a hilarious meme in the middle of a meeting and you laugh. And she laughs, and you feel a little bit more alive, right? And then you text her back, and then she texts you back, and now we're off to the races, right? And that's same with money, that's same with power. Yeah, it's all proxy for, am I safe?
It's interesting, because the humor thing is such a fascinating, and again, my mentor, Floyd Sharp, he was big on humor. Yeah. 9 out of 10 of his jokes did not even qualify as dad jokes. They were terrible, but he enjoyed them. And so that made it worthwhile. And I find today, you know, I find something that's hysterical and I send it out and nobody thinks it's funny. So then there's this
send disconnect. Them to me because I'll think they're funny. Yeah,
then there's this disconnect and I go, oh, I'm anxious. I shouldn't have done that. I'm wasting people's time. So back to money, sex, and power for just a minute. I have this theory, and you're the two PhDs. You can help me. I have this theory that all these things are insatiable.
Yeah.
Money, sex, and power are by nature insatiable.
They're ghosts. You can never catch them.
God
That's right.
gave them to us, however. Our level of satisfaction, and back to your comment about MMA and the guy who keeps us cool, our ability to be content in any situation, that's the goal, right?
Right. Yeah. The hesitation some of my friends who are mental health professionals had with the construct of this book even was the idea that nobody chooses anxiety, John. And no, nobody would choose that. It's miserable. But we do make choices on a daily basis that provide a context for how our body's going to respond when we get overwhelmed. And so, yeah, there's never, it's the old David Foster Wallace quote. We are beings, and he's an atheist, by the way, we are beings created to worship. Period, end of story. And if you worship money, you will never have enough.
Yeah.
And if you worship beauty, you will never, you'll see every fine line and wrinkle. You'll never be beautiful enough. If you worship shiny things, you'll never have enough. And you'll always notice your neighbor's even shinier thing. And so you go back to, okay, what is it that I'm going to worship then? And what you put your, the choices that you make way upstream dictate if your fields flood or if they are dry or if they get just enough. You're exactly right. If you chase one of those three or all those three, A, you're going to die young, and B, you're going to take down everybody with you.
One of the ways I think about audiences when I preach or speak or at a conference, I think about decades, John, what they're dealing with in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. I'm edging up close to 70 now. It almost seems like there was a Jack London short story called A Piece of Steak You Should Read. It's a powerful story. But it's the transfer, what it takes to become mature, your spending, your youth, and your strength. So he tells the story of a fighter in a ring. He sees this huge guy. He's massive. He's fighting an old guy called Sandel. And it's a powerful and sad picture of you've got to spend your youth and your strength and your vigor to get the experience in life that anxiety loses its grip, that money, sex, and power lose their grip on you. Not completely, but push back on me. I'm just curious. I watch the 20s and 30s and how frenetic they are. I tell my daughter, it's amazing any of you kids survived. The technology and the stuff they have for child rearing for children today, it's wonderful. But it's like, I don't know how y'all survived. We had none of that. And it seems there's this frenetic energy. And do we have to be older? That's what I'm asking. Does it take losing your strength and vigor and going, hey, it really didn't matter?
You know, man, dude, we do have to hang out offline. Maybe we'll just record it, that conversation, because that's a long conversation. I spent 10 years doing the whole dance. It's part of it's good and part of it's not good, right? And, you know, it's really good, but then also it can be really bad. And I found myself saying the exact same thing when I was teaching graduate school about cocaine. Cocaine's amazing until it kills you. Alcohol is amazing until it kills you. I think this frenetic madness is the same. The challenge we have now, I heard this recently and I almost stood up where I was. If I hadn't have been in an airport with headphones on, I would have stood up and cheered. But the person said, I don't want to hear again. I don't want to hear the sentiment again, these kids these days.
Sure.
And he said, the kids are exactly as they've always been. It's the adults that have changed. And I think what we have under our belt is a group of parents who came home from World War I and a group of parents who came home from World War II. And we have the most disconnected human being. And they didn't have a tribe to come home to. And every civilization in human history has a tribe that celebrates you when you get home. And they have rituals and they have re-engagement processes. And we came home and my granddad went to work.
Yeah.
Alone, and got behind a newspaper when he got home. An amazing man. And that generation built some of the most extraordinary things, but they did it all by themselves. And then they raised kids, who then raised kids, who then raised us. And what we have is this energy. To answer your question, no, I don't think we have to. We don't have to have that. Obviously, there's going to be lessons you learn. And I think there's lessons you can only learn by getting punched in the nose, getting your butt kicked. And I think we've extracted that from our culture. That's going to cost us. There's no question about it. But I do think there are lessons to be learned from being fully connected to the adults in your life and having them bring you along. And so some of the greatest parenting advice I got early on was hold your kid's face. There's a physiological component to that. Grab your kids by the face, tell them that you love them every single day of their life, and take them with you to see you interact with other adults as often as possible. And what they'll learn is how to talk to grownups, that other grownups have problems, that your dad's actually pretty cool, or maybe your dad's not pretty cool, but they're going to absorb this stuff. And you're going to have some more differentiated kids. And yeah, someone's going to break their heart. And they got to learn from that. Sure. They have to get beat up. They're going to get fired. Their job's going to get taken away. That's life. Someone they love is going to get cancer. You're going to die and you leave your kids by yourselves. That's part of just existence. But I don't think it has to be anxious. You can be sad. It can be full of grief. It can be hard. It can be scary. But it doesn't have to be this low-level hum that never lets you sleep, never lets you fully connect with somebody. That's what I think I wish parents would come back to, is stop with the frenetic energy. Stop with the got to run, got to go, got to do, got to get. It's not real, man.
But
you give your kid you and some mud and a stick.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I didn't mean to differentiate entirely that you can't learn those things. It just seems like those are the decades we learn that stuff. And and when you got small children, that's your world, baby.
That's
your world. Yeah. It's and they're busy until they collapse and then you collapse. And then when they start,
you get up and go again.
Yeah, it's like wash and repeat. You know, it's a tough chapter. But, you know, there's those moments in there that are delightful. There's moments that are just, you know, wonderful memories for them and hopefully them and you. But then when, as your kids get older and they go out, once they hit high school, you know, I used to tell parents, you got 4 summers.
That's right.
The school year is pretty programmed. And when they want to be with their friends, not you. So you got 4 summers and then they're done, really 3, because they're going to be gone if they go to college. Once they hit college, they're gone functionally. You're an empty nester. You're just writing checks. But the relational disconnect becomes hopefully friend. And, you know, not parents so much, but this is an adult now. And then the delight, I mean, my adult kids are, it's the best time of my weak to be around my adult children. They're phenomenal human beings, very different in a lot of ways, similar in some ways. But the only reason I bring that up is take a big breath and go, you know, there's going to be seasons where you're going to have more anxiety than others. That's what I was trying to get at.
I think it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, which is this idea that if it's not all perfect all the time, that something's broken. I have people call my show, Doc, and they'll say, I'm in a sexless marriage. I hate my job, this and that. Me and my spouse aren't connecting in any way. As I dig in, it almost invariably pops up, oh, we have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old, and I'm pregnant with number 4. And I'm always like, hey, lead with that. Just lead with that. Call me back in 5 years. Everything, you just keep everything duct taped together and keep driving and figure it out. And yes, there's some tips and tricks along the way, but you're right where you're supposed to be. It's not supposed to be fun or good right now, right? But one day your last kid is going to get up and go to the potty by themselves, and you are going to run through the neighborhood screaming and yelling.
Yeah, sleep through the night.
Yes, yes. One day your husband's going to come out of the bathroom wearing just his whitey tighties, and he's going to be the hottest guy you ever seen. That's years from now, not right now.
I need to tell. So wait, I got to tell Cindy that.
Hey, it's coming. It's coming. Hey, once you cross that 7-0.
So let's talk. The last chapter is, almost last chapter, is the hard way. Give our friends a little tease. And what's the hard path?
The hard path is there's an illusion that's been built, which is there's an easy way and then there's a hard way, right? The easy way is I'm not going to care about what I eat. That's only for health nuts and for goofballs. The easy way is saying things like, well, my marriage just ran its course. It just ended. It ran out of gas, and that's fine. I'm going to move on to the next one. The hard way is I'm going to stay in shape, and I'm going to like be somewhat conscious about what I eat. I'm going to be intentional about my marriage, and when things get hard, I'm going to go to counseling and work through these things. The reality is being 100 pounds overweight is really, really hard. Losing 100 pounds is really, really hard. Having a marriage dissolve and having to split up kids and finances and heartbreak is really, really hard. Having a good marriage is almost impossible hard. And so I think the illusion is there's an easy way to do life and a hard way. And what I'm trying to paint in this chapter is there is no easy way. It will cost you dramatically. So choose the hard path that's going to get you to the place you want to be, not to a place that's going to end up pulling your life underwater, right? And so there's just not an easy path.
The book is called Building a Non-Anxious Life by Dr. John Deloney. You'll find information, as always, in the show notes of the program or anywhere you purchase books online. Take a look at it. The Minimalist Podcast, The Dave Ramsey Show, The Ramsey Solutions Show, you can find John all over YouTube. So take a look further at what he's got to offer, and you'll be the beneficiary. John, thanks for jumping on the podcast today.
I appreciate your hospitality, and let's get a fun topic to discuss, and let's hang out soon.
Did you know that In Context is fully funded by our listeners like you? If you are a regular listener, would you consider giving a one-time or perhaps monthly donation? You can give at michaelincontext.com. In Context is produced by Hannah Seymour, mixed and mastered by Sonomorphic, and music composed by Tycho and Blair Masters.